University, Yerchaikala, Rav Kook, and A Religious Zionism of Inclusion.
Yeah? Yeah. Okay, good afternoon. It's nice to be having an opportunity to learn about something that's off our high school curriculum for the most part. I'm C.B. Mubershal, the head of school at Central. My goal today is really to try to take some of the mystery of Rav Kook help to elucidate what his broader perspective was, how some of the different experiences in his life helped to shape those ideas using some of his own texts. I will say that as a student myself, I always found Rav Kook to be so incredibly difficult. In the sense that if you asked who he is and what he does and what he represents, Rav Kook takes so many of the domains of Torah study and seems to touch them and to shape them in a way that is almost unfamiliar. He's not a halachist, he's not a Kabbalist, he's not just a Zionist. He's a poet and he's a writer and he is philosophical and he's Kabbalistic and he's mystical and he seems to be connected to the nationalist movement and has a tremendous Lev Rachav that we don't necessarily see in so many other places, you know. So for me, when we want to get to know the richness of someone as complicated and as multi-layered as Rav Kook, it's often helpful to place his own personal life experiences into the storyline because that helps us appreciate from where some of this depth emerges. So to be really anecdotal and non-historical for a moment, a story is told about Rav Kook as a young rabbi in a small town where he took up his first rabbinic post in Lithuania. And it was Erev Shabbos, and as everyone is rushing from the marketplace, preparing themselves and gathering their wares and closing shops and deciding what it was that they needed to do for Shabbos and how they were going to get there, people noticed that a poor cobbler was still standing in the doorway of his shop. What they didn't know was that he had collected his week's wares and did his own calculations and realized that he didn't have what it took to go home, stop at the marketplace, and be properly prepared for Shabbos, bringing what his family needed. And so he stood there in the doorway, somewhat dumbfounded, and really at a loss. Right? This is clearly someone who had always been prepared for Shabbos and was struck by his lack of ability to provide for his family. And he stood there. And everyone else went home, and everyone else went to shul. And on their return, this merchant was still standing there. Rav Kook was walking home from shul and heard people murmuring in front. How could he stand there? Chil Shabbos, not doing anything. Shabbos, the store's open. What's he doing? What's he doing? And Rav Kook walked past this man and said, Shabbos. And continued walking. And sort of like shaken, the story's told, shaken from his, dumbfoundedness as to what he was supposed to do, how he's supposed to show up unprepared for Shabbos, empty-handed for his family. This man runs after Rav Kook and sort of asks apologetically, nothing was going on, there was no Chil Shabbos, I wasn't prepared, I wasn't able to do it. And Rav Kook promised him that he would help him every week to get ready for Shabbos, so he wouldn't have to be at such a loss at the last minute. And so much so, he said to him, come with me now, bring your family with you now to my house for Shabbos. After Shabbos, you can take our Neirot Shabbat so that you can keep them always in your store if you ever need, you know, your last minute preparations. So I don't know whether the story is true. Typically they're apocryphal, but what it captures about the way that Rav Kook made an imprint on people's appreciation for what he stood for, the three different elements that I think are borne out in his philosophy. The first is this notion that you approach another Jew, regardless of what it looks like, with an assumption that they are in it for the right reasons. That there's Kedusha present in the moment. Someone looking like their Mechal Shabbos, someone standing outside their store as you're returning for Shabbos, from shul for your Shabbos meal deserves a good Shabbos. That assumption is this deep kesher and this deep Ahava Yisrael that Rav Kook represented. The second principle was that it wasn't just an assumption. There is an implication of that view that calls upon you to do something with it. That requires of you, when you see another Jew who looks like they don't do what you do, you assume A, and then you do B. That there is an implication and a requirement for every Jew to act in a certain way towards another Jew. And then the third element is that sometimes that requires personal self-sacrifice. So each of those components, again, whether the story is true or not, is irrelevant, are consistent with the ways in which Rav Kook's life plays out and the perspective of his orientation towards the challenging time that he lived in, both in Europe and in Israel, and the ways in which he tried to guide everyone towards a much more complicated and holistic view of what Am Yisrael needed in order to unify itself with Eretz Yisrael and Torat Eretz Yisrael. So who was Rav Kook? His life itself really is woven in ways that we see those same values emerging. First, Rav Kook was born into a very unique family. His father came from a long line of Litvish Rabbanim, Rav Shlomo Zalman HaKohen Kook, and his mother came from a long line of Hasidish families. His mother's name was Perel Zlata Feldman. In fact, his own tutors, because he was recognized as an Eloi as a young child, his own personal tutors came from both traditions. His mother's family was very closely connected to the original Rav Menachem Mendel Schneerson, the Tzemach Tzedek of the Lubavitch dynasty, and his father was very closely connected to the Lashon Yeshiva. At 18, when Rav Kook was considered to have outgrown the personal melamdim that were brought, he was sent to the Lashon to learn, and he learned personally with the Netziv. And certainly those two rabbinic traditions we see having a strong influence in his thinking. Rav Kook continues throughout his life to write halakhically, to write gadzically, to write kabbalistically, to write with literary flair and with poetry, and very often interwove those genres in a way that make it difficult to really understand what Rav Kook is after. I think it was about 19 years old, very soon after being in Volozhin, Rav Kook marries the Panovitcher Rav's daughter, who dies shortly thereafter, and then he's remarried again to the daughter of the brother of one of the other Rashi Yeshivot. And it's very clear that he has a rabbinic destiny. He does take a first stellar in right near his father's hometown, Dvinsk, and we see some of these, you know, anecdotal stories coming out at that time. Rav Kook's philosophy in his early life is very, very much more oriented towards Volozhin. We see the beginnings of writing about Am Yisrael, and he is clearly influenced and aware of the fact that what's the biggest challenge in the time of European Jewry, especially rooted in the yeshiva of Volozhin. What are they most worried about at that time? The Haskala. They're most worried about the corrosive effects of secularism. And what's worse than secularism? Why is Zionism worse than secularism? Why? How could it be worse than secularism? Pushkin is, there's got to be things that are worse than Zionism. They're at least talking about Eretz Israel. How could Zionism be worse? Because it's the wolf in sheep's clothing. Because it looks and sounds like it's after something kadosh, and it's worse because it's coming from, who are these people, right? Can you really throw off the yoke of of Torah and mitzvot and still be claiming to be accomplishing something that's bringing us towards this tzion that we're diving for all the time, right? So the wolf in sheep's clothing is worse than the wolf, right? And that's clearly the issue. And Rav Kook has an inclination. No one would ever call Rav Kook a proto-Zionist. He is not one of the early Zionists. He isn't. He actually skips over that entirely. Rav Kook, who are some of the early Zionists? Tzviyosh Kalischer, right? There are people within the rabbinic tradition, within the yeshivot, that are writing essays, persuasive essays, to say, we need to help the establishment. The yeshuv is deserving. This is kadosh. Rav Kook doesn't start there. Rav Kook starts at a different, from a different angle entirely. Rav Kook starts by really building an interconnected, woven tapestry, asserting that, okay, there are three elements that are inherent and natural to all of Am Yisrael, and those are interconnected to each other, and as long as you touch one of them, you are touching the others a priori. You have no choice. Tar Yisrael, Eretz Yisrael, and Am Yisrael are all one component of what Rav Kook calls Inyan Eloki within Am Yisrael. So, how does that help us? Why is it okay to be supporting and engaged and fully invested in the growth of Am Yisrael, of the nationalist movement, which was the strongest challenge to the Volozhin yeshiva? Because Am Yisrael, even if it's being, if this cause called Am Yisrael, even if it's being driven down the tracks by someone who is completely anti-religious and secular and does not accept Ol Malchut Shemayim or Ol HaMitzvot, still, by virtue of them pushing for Am Yisrael, they're pulling Torah Eretz Yisrael, and they're pulling Kedushat Eretz Yisrael at the same time. Those are interwoven, interconnected. So if one goes, the other gets connected and pulled along as well. So we may not approve that that's the priority and that it could be divorced. Rav Kook says these three components cannot be divorced. And he bases that not just on an assertion that this is a unique quality of what it means to be a member of Am Yisrael. He goes much further. He builds on the basic growing notion that there's a cultural, national, humanistic quality of what it means to be a full human being. All people have spiritual aspirations, national aspirations, and humanistic aspirations. All people have that, and they're always interwoven, whether or not you're aware of it. So Rav Kook goes even further. There is a unique quality of these type of interconnected features of Am Yisrael, but that's just because that's a natural condition for all human beings. So I found one text, and I wanted to share that with you, where we see Rav Kook really talking about Am Yisrael, but recognize that he uses these three categories, the religious spirit, the humanist spirit, and the national spirit. He uses these categories and asserts that they are pre-existing. They are just a priori conditions of what it means to be a human being. So it's clear he's listening to the ideas of the ages. So you have it in Hebrew and in English right here. This comes from Orot. You can follow along in English if you'd like to. And I want to read it carefully. As Rav Kook writes, even though this is prose, it's always poetry. There's always specific words that are being chosen and references that are not explicit but are very present. So, Breishit Matoshal Ha'am Hazah, in the very beginning of this of these people, Asher Yadah Lekro B'Shem HaRayon HaElokhi HaBaror VaHatahor Be'et, who knew, these the beginnings of our people who knew to identify and to recognize this Rayon HaElokhi, which was clear and pure, be'et ha-shalton ha-kabir sha-ha-elilut bitum'at pra'uta, in the time where people were idolaters and were not in the slightest bit invested in monotheism, nitgalta ha-she'ifa, it was revealed, this hope and this idealism, la-hakim tzibur enoshi gadol, asher yishmor et derech Hashem la'asot tzedakah u'mishpat, to establish Tzibur Enoshi Gadol, a nationhood or a peoplehood, it's not quite an Am yet, right? Who would be guided by Yishmor Derech Hashem Lasot Tzedakah U'Mishpat. This is a quote directly from, where is this Pasuk? This is when Hashem says, why do I have to tell Avram about what I'm going to do in Sodom? Because I know Avram's going to be the father who will direct others who will be Derech Hashem Lasot Tzedakah U'Mishpat, right? So he's referencing, where did this idea of secular Zionism really find its roots? They're not really just indebted to Herzl, right? It goes all the way back to Avram Avinu. And Avram Avinu, before a nation, had a more broadly defined appreciation of there being a creator, a Rayon Eloki, the notion that you need to have a spiritual aspiration to move beyond yourself, to appreciate your place in this world, and to know that there's something meaningful, tzedakah, mishpat, lasot derech Hashem, lishmor derech Hashem, something that goes, moves you religiously. So here he says, this Rayon Eloki, it goes way back in history, and it isn't so you could say it's unique to Avram, and Avram is Avraham and Goyim. You could also say it's unique to Avram, and Avram is the first Ivri. You could go both ways, but he's very careful to say it goes all the way back in history. Zuhi hashi'ifa, this is the hope, Sheba'a mikolach ha'achlacha ha'brua v'ha'aza, v'atvi'a ha'musarit ha'klala ha'kololat v'harama. What is this she'ifa, this great grand ideal? It's strong, it's courageous, it's ethical, but it is a general principle. What is it? Lehotzi et ha'anashiyut mitachat sevel nora shel tzirot ruchaniyot v'chamriyot lahaviyena l'chayei chofesh mle'a hod ve'eden. What is this? This is the effort of trying to bring humanity. It's not Am Yisrael alone. To bring humanity out of the very materialistic, burdened, basic bestial life of what it means to be a beast of burden, and to raise them up to a chofesh mla'i hod ve'eden, a certain type of freedom that is as grand and glorious as can be if humanity is ennobled be'or ha'idiyah ha'elokit, that it should be enlightened in this godly divine spirit. La'atzliach b'zeh. Again, it's kol ha'adam kulo. Humanity, a human being himself, becomes his best self when he reaches in and is inspired by what we could call a religious spiritual force. Something that pushes him beyond his physicality, beyond his immediacy, beyond his own needs. So one force that Rav Kook appreciates is important in human beings, and also obviously in Am Yisrael, is this Ra'ayon Eloki. The second force, Limloa shel she'ifazu tzarich dafka, she'tzibur zeh yiyeh ba'al medina politit v'socialit. Okay, so in order to really get to this level of self-fulfillment, where you're enabled to reach past yourself, what do you have? Listen, education never existed before people had bread and butter. You don't have the luxury to go and like philosophize about anything if you can't put food on the table, right? So you must have a stable political, social entity that's established, that protects your ability and your right, and allows you to do that. So this national force, this force that asks, this political force that helps us construct the proper matrix through which we then can reach out and be better than just our immediate needs of 9 to 5, that is also a force that we have to recognize that is present, and again, in all of humanity. And he goes further, it's political, it's sociological, v'chisei mamlacha lu'umit, and it's also national. That's what is necessary in order to create this greater self-fulfillment on a religious plane. And then he talks about Am Chacham. He uses the pasuk, right? Am Chacham v'Navon, the goy gadol. You can use your wisdom, but it isn't an individualistic wisdom. It's a wisdom that's applied to creating the proper political setting so that societies emerge that help us strive and achieve. Why does he start with this spiritual inyan eloki and go next only to the political? Because there has to be a purpose and a goal for that political entity, right? It's not just having rules and laws, not for the purpose of having order, but for the purpose of being the proper context for this idiyah elokit. And that's what he says right here in the middle, the hadiyah elokit hamuchletet, Misholet Shama, it is in its richest place there. It rules umechaye et ha'am ve'et ha'aretz b'mor chaya. That's the context that allows the national spirit to emerge in its divinity and in its greatest sense. Now, who gets to participate in this grand goal of building a politic, of building a societal structure, of allowing all of this wonderful human divine force to emerge? Who participates in this? Rav Kook says probably his most radical statement at this point in time is that it is an endeavor that every human being in all stages of life, in all positions of power or lack thereof, has an opportunity and has the ability to contribute to this undertaking. All the ranks of humanity, from the elite to the middle class, those who have the education and those who don't. He says, even if you go to just the very last few words, Afilu hayoter namuch umigusham. Those who are in the lowest of all classes still have a place within this grand ideal. And we see that this is very general, and he isn't talking about which groups he agrees with and which groups he doesn't agree with and which political stances might be problematic and how do we deal with the fact that people are anti-halakha and don't believe in Hashem. This formulation is as integrative and inclusive as you can possibly be. Sounds super philosophical, right? And this, yet, I really was very grateful to have found just one paragraph, because Rav Kook keeps going back to this principle. He really sees not just the issues of the politics of Zionists, of secular Zionists and religious Zionists, he sees the entire world and all of existence as being this interwoven, right, complicated, hierarchical structure in which material and spiritual, national and political, religious and secular, are all being interconnected, and hopefully, he says, not with this sense, I'll explain this in a minute, not with the sense of anything goes, but hopefully all deriving from the potential that God has given this planet and moving us closer to the actualization of that potential. Rav Kook does not simply, it's not this like simple PC approach of anything goes, right? That there was an essay that was written on tolerance in Rav Kook. I think it was written on the eve of the assassination of Rabin, because obviously of the tensions that tragedy stoked. And the explanation that I saw was that a tolerance of anything goes is like in Hebrew, it's sablanut. I can tolerate it. It has nothing to do with inclusion, right? I can tolerate it means I'm simply gonna let it be because I'm also just as likely to ignore it, right, as I am to value it. That is not the tolerance of Rav Kook. What Rav Kook is talking about is that there is a inyan eloki in potentiate present within Jews who are engaged in one of those three things, and that we need to recognize and stoke, and that has the potential to grow into something else. Those three things are Torah, Yisrael, Eretz Yisrael, physical land, just the actual physical land, and Am Yisrael, just the national. And he puts those all in the same playing field. There's not more Kedusha. He's very explicit about that. There's not more Kedusha in Torah Yisrael than there is to Eretz Yisrael or than there is to Am Yisrael. And that's what allows for him to say the type of inclusion that he's expecting is one that's much more akin to a symphony, right, as opposed to simply being able to walk past somebody and not asserting that they bother you significantly. I thought it would be valuable to see how Rav Kook's basic principles, as we've outlined them, the religious, spiritual force, the national force, and the humanistic force that he asserts are so at play, emerge in some of his basic writings. And so I brought you a page of Parshanut that comes, that Rav Kook attaches to the Hodu Tefillah of Shacharit. And many of these psukim actually are from Divrei HaYamim, but in these psukim and in Rav Kook's Parshanut on it, we see how consistent these values are, and how he's not giving an essay here, he's not giving a speech, he's not telling you what to do with your tzedaka money. He is telling you what it means to be a Jew who davens with these principles in mind, right? And so in a very basic level, this is the way Rav Kook sees even our Jewish practice. So let's just look at each of these segments for to see what emerges, which values emerge, and how they connect to what we've seen already. So, Vayamidah LeYaakov LeChok LeYisrael Brit Olam. This is one phrase within the Hodu of Shacharit, and it contrasts the first component, the first portion of this phrase with the second. Vayamidah LeYaakov LeChok LeYisrael Brit Olam. And what he says is, there's a reason that we're talking about Yaakov in the beginning and Yisrael in the end. There's a reason why we talk about a chok in talking about the establishment of a certain principle, and then we talk about Brit Olam. So let's look at how he looks at these phrases and those words. Okay, what is this? He says that chok implies, chok is a law, right? Here, chok is talking about the natural law, the essence of Am Yisrael. A chok, he says, noten lo et haftacha shehaamada hatadirit. It gives you some type of assurance and some type of promise of some perpetual, permanent condition, shehik shura b'dvar atzmi, that's actually essentially a part of their nature. Shehu yoter etan mehakesher shel devar mikri. It's not an accidental quality of this connection to Yaakov. It is chok. It's natural law. It's just part of who we are as people. So, what is the subject of this phrase? Et kedushata shel Eretz Yisrael b'skulataha hapnimit. The Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael, in its essential internal qualities, hit im Hashem yitbarach, im hateva haruchani haatzmi hayisodi shel ha'uma. Eretz Yisrael, the land, the geography of it, actually, when we talk about it in the Gemara, it says, avirad Eretz Yisrael machkima, the land, the geography, the space is matim, is made in a way that it actually fits like a glove with the teva of the essential nature of Am Yisrael. When people say, I go there and I feel like I'm home, it's not because it's nefesh b'nefesh, it's not because of the songs, it's not because of the great marketing. That's what Rav Kook would say. It's actually avirah Eretz Yisrael, it's not machkima in a way that it enlightens you about something outside of you, it enlightens you about something inside of you. And that's Rav Kook's understanding. Okay? And that, he said, why does that start with Yaakov? Because who was Yaakov? Yaakov was not Yisrael, right? Before he was Yisrael. Before he was Yisrael, Yaakov was a Jew, right? An individual, sort of fighting for an identity. on his own, the one who travels, right? Not the one who stays, the one who travels, the one who's not sure, the one who's not certain, who has to come back home, who has to face his opponents, the one who doesn't have the existential, externals, accidental qualities that give him all the assurances, the one who perhaps really is the wandering Jew, right? He's the one who needs to be told it's a chok. It's tiv'i, it's atzma'i, it's in your essence. It's not something, you know, and he's the one who's not sure that the brachot are really his. He's the one who has to be told it's a chok. And then, right, we can say, L'Yisrael brit olam. Then it becomes potentially available to us as a nation to have a permanent kesher. And that's this last phrase in this section that I underlined, kesher nitzchil u'ma kula l'Yisrael. The permanent condition, the connection that is unbroken is for all of Yisrael. Eretz, im eretz chemdato, with our glorious land, asher ohevet netzach aleha charuta al luach libam. It's like engraved in our hearts. Asher liadi ad hi kayemet, laadei ad, I'm sorry, that it is permanent and forever, liyisrael brit olam. And that's why the lashon is of one of a brit olam. It's a covenant that God has given to us. It's essential to us. We, no matter where we are, no matter who we are, alone or not, it will be part of our nature. So that what is, he says, Hashem implants it. It's way back in Bereishis. Forget about Herzl. It's way back in Bereishis. Okay? Second phrase. Le'mor l'cha atein eretz kanan chevel nachalatchem. Again, a contrast in the two phrases. What do you notice? L'cha versus Nachalachem, right? Again, we go from the singular to the plural. What else emerges that's very matim to Rav Kook's philosophy here? Hashem gives it to us as an individual, still Eretz Kanan, and then it becomes Chevel Nachalachem. It's a Nachala, right? You don't actually have to do anything, right? It's a Nachala. It will continue. There's a question as to whether Chevel is intended to imply, right? It's not said here, so I'm just saying there's interpretation. You know, the interconnectedness of all people's efforts to hold on to the Nachala. Chevel implies like a rope that's a binding. Okay, that's maybe reading more than Rav Kook even tells us. And then we go to the next phrase, B'hiyotcha masai mispar kim'at v'garim bo. Again, even if you're not a nation. So nationhood is connected to land. No, they're not interdependent. They each pull on each other. Even Masai Mispar, even if you're a tiny amount and you have no nationhood, even if you see yourselves, Garimbo, as foreigners living there, you're not. Your connection precedes the creation of the nation. And there are these references that Rav Kook is trying to establish, that is, if you just look at the middle of the paragraph and all the different lines that are underlined here, the kesher ruchani mitaved bein ha'am v'aretz. U'ma she'en ken ha'kesher ha'eloki mimkor ha'kodesh kishen shen nitkashra knesset Yisrael b'ketushat aretz chemda she'edchil ha'chotem ha'kadosh. The beginnings of this, your kedusha is essential. Your connection to Eretz Yisrael is essential. It begins way beyond any awareness. It's there. So therefore, Rav Kook is happy to participate with people who are completely clueless. Doesn't matter to me that you're not aware that the train is going in this direction. You're on the train. Let's work together.
It is pre-programmed
in a way that Ruf is basically hoping that the simplest scratch will allow, right, on the surface, will allow the internal, the essential qualities of Kedusha to emerge, because it is Kadosh before you make it Kadosh. It's there. The holiness is present in Am Yisrael, the holiness is present in Torah Yisrael, and the holiness is present in Eretz Yisrael. All you need to do is to be continuously active in this. And if you're continuously active in it, you're producing Kedusha whether you're aware of it or not. whether you know you're producing Kedusha or not, it is totally there. So where else can we get a great insight into Rav Kook's impression as to where these efforts are going? I brought you a section from the Haggadah, Hashtahacha L'shana Haba Be'arad Yisrael. Of course, that would be a wonderful place to hear what Rav Kook has to say. Now we're here, and in the next year we should be in Eretz Yisrael. So what does Rav Kook have to say here? Oh, thank you so much. So he says, Hadvarim she'einam muchanim, things that are not actually actualized yet, tzrichim zman rav lehit pachtutam, that they take some time in order to develop. Aval, ma shekvar muchan be'atzmuto, but something already is fully developed in its essence, v'sibot, and the sort of causes, stadiot, the side causes, the accidental conditions, there are these accidental conditions that don't allow, that prevent the reality, the potential to emerge into actualization. Tekef, kishatafzur hamnia, as soon as you take away the obstacle, yotzei ma shemuchan kfar el hapoel. You take away that which is already prepared and it just bursts forward. So he says we're living in a time where I see, and this is really like called visionary. If anyone talks about Rav Kook as a visionary, how he was able to formulate this without feeling the same type of caution or the same type of foreboding sense of Judaism going down the tubes that was all around him in Europe. That's what everyone said. The fact that they were reading, who were they reading at the time? The fact that they were reading whoever they were reading behind the Gemara that was really threatening in the yeshiva, right? Probably to Yiddish ones too. To Rav Kook was not so disturbing. They were still sitting in the yeshiva. To him, that meant they were invested in Torah Israel. So Rav Kook was able to really be a visionary and say there is this force. There is this both in each Jewish person and certainly in the world. That's a spiritual force that pushes in one direction. That is a humanist force that cannot help but try to connect that person back to their nation, back to their land. All we need to do is, what's the obstacle? There are lots of obstacles. All we need to do is get a political acceptance, we need to have some international recognition, a little bit of money, maybe get rid of some of the anti-Semitism. There's a lot, but his view was, take that rock out and the stream is going to go flowing. And we just need to get as much as recognize that whatever the conditions are, we need to remove those obstacles, whatever those, and I would venture to say that he would say some of those obstacles were the cynicism and the fear and the godless mentality that said, this can't be, this is not the way it happens, right? It all changes for Rav Kook. 1904, which is a very auspicious day, right, in Zionism, was Rav, 1904 is when Herzl passes away. So 1904, Rav Kook is appointed chief rabbi of Yafo, small town, right? He goes. A few months later, Herzl dies. Prior to Rav Kook going to Israel, we see these same writings. These writings, I don't have an exact date for them, but they're not like that radical shift. But when Rav Kook gets to Israel, and he's in Yafo, he's actually very connected to the yeshiva world, right? Just familiar-wise. He has extraordinary approbations, gorgeous, like, gushing letters from the Chafetz Chaim, from every Rosh Yeshiva, about how amazing this Gaon is who's going to Eretz Yisrael, and how much everyone, you know, you traveled then, you didn't get, you don't have likes on Facebook, you got everyone's haskama. Everyone had their letters, you put down your package and you had all your things. This is why you should know that I'm worth talking to. So Rav Kook had the most amazing portfolio of haskamot. And he gets to Eretz Yisrael and he realizes there's this incredible opportunity to really take these values and put them to work. What's going on there in 1904 before Herzl dies? What's going on there? You have incredible tensions between the old Yishuv and the new Yishuv, right? You have this growing Torah world and people who had drained the swamps saying, who are you? Are you coming from Europe? And we're working the land. Where do you think your milk is coming from? And Rav Kook in Yafo, think about geography and how much that an impact it has. In Yafo, Rav Kook went and spent his time in all of these little yeshiva rooms and had, I don't speak to the historicity of it, it's anecdotally told that Peretz and Brenner all came to his Dash Lishit, would sit there, right, and listen to his Divrei Torah, because Rav Kook spoke with a language of nationalism and of value, that what everyone brought to the table was part of the symphony that he appreciated. And he traveled between the yeshiva world and the yeshiva room, and he was the only one doing it. And then Herzl passes away. What does that say to Rav Kook? A piece of my obstacle, right? My bit is being removed. And he gives a eulogy for Herzl that compares Herzl to Mashiach ben Yosef and the oncoming of Mashiach ben David. That was the first formulation of this really being a movement that was developing and changing and connected Rav Kook's theoretics to what was actually happening, okay? Mind you, how do you know you're doing a good job? Half the people hate what you're saying, right? And Rav Kook really was not very, that eulogy was not very well received. Why was he giving a eulogy? Herzl was the enemy for many religious communities in Israel at the time. And Rav Kook really tried to be the glue for the old and the new yeshiva. He realized that where is the spiritual guidance for the Haredi world in Israel coming from at the time, and around 1904, 1905, and that time, it was really coming back from Europe. It didn't have the full establishment in Israel yet. And Rav Kook goes to the Aguda conference.
So he comes back.
Rav Kook goes to try to sell his wares there. He knew that that's where they needed to be convinced. 1914, he goes to the Aguda conference. And what happens? 1914, World War I breaks out. And Rav Kook is stuck. He can't get back. Rav Kook stays first for a year in Switzerland, and then he gets a shteller at Machzike Hadass in London. Very prominent Haredi shul. And he's there, and I think that was around 1915, towards the end of 1915. He's there for approximately a year. When in 1917, what happens? 1917, the Balfour Declaration. The stone is out of the water. We are no longer, the biggest Haredi obstacle to religious Zionism is that you can't go against Umat HaOlam. You can't tell that, you can't assert that we now have a Medina. You have to be given that opportunity, and here it is on paper. We are giving that opportunity. Rav Kook is on fire. Rav Kook takes this Balfour Declaration as an indication that, in fact, the secular Zionists got the ball rolling, and Hashem is simply waiting for every obstacle and moving them slowly, one at a time, at a time, at a time. So this was really a fundamentally critical transition. I'm going to skip this text on the land and move to the last thing that I wanted to show you, because I don't want to give the impression, like I said earlier, that Rav Kook simply accepted all secular Zionism as Kadosh. He really had a discerning view that said, if there's a sense of Kedusha here, right, if you're moving towards not just your own sensibilities, your own personal individual goals, but if you're moving towards the Am, there's Kedusha present. If you're moving towards Torah, there's Kedusha present. If you're moving towards developing the land, there's Kedusha present. And he pushed, he was willing to engage with each of those opponents who were trying to represent Zionism, push us in a different direction. He engaged and he fought on those principles. And one of the most beautiful manifestations of that is Rav Kook's own composition that he offered as an alternative to HaTikvah. HaTikvah was actually, I think, it's still not officially the anthem of the State of Israel. The flag has been accepted, but HaTikvah is just an unofficial anthem. And Rav Kook was very worried that it would become the official anthem and put forward his own version. He called it HaEmunah. HaTikvah was written in 1878 by Naftali Imber. And the version that you have here is the original. It's been revised and shortened, and the one that we sing today has elements of the original, but it's not the entirety of it. And this is Rav Kook's parallel and very different. It's written afterwards, obviously. It's his response to HaTikvah. He's, what's that? I couldn't remember. I didn't write it down, but it is definitely, it's much later. I believe it's closer to the 1917 time, but I didn't check the date. And I do know, do you know?
No, I was just going to ask a question.
Just 1 second. I do know that it was written intentionally in response to Imber's HaTikvah, and it's nice to look at that. You could break it into four different stanzas, all of them. I'll try to show you some of the comparisons that I think are important. Well,
I wanted to know if Rob Cook mentioned any consideration of the Shir Hamalot of Yossel Rosenblatt, which almost became the HaTikvah. And if, also, if you're aware of the disagreements between Rabbi Yoel Teitelbaum, the Satmar Rebbe, and Rob Cook.
So yes, to the second. I don't know anything about the Shir Hamalot of Yossel Rosenblatt, but with regard to the Satmar Rebbe's opposition, so Rav Kook understood the Balfour Declaration really to be the biggest indicator that he was wrong. That even if you accepted that opposition, the opposition is how can you, the time of Mashiach comes not as a not initiated by the Jewish people, it has to be granted to us by God through the international community. And so the Balfour Declaration was the biggest indicator to Rav Kook that qualifier had been satisfied. Okay, so if you look here, on the right-hand side we have Imber, on the left-hand side we have Rav Kook. In the first stanza, the first stanza of Imber versus the first two stanzas, 1 through 8, of Rav Kook, really says everything. Imber takes on a tone of, and we feel it when we sing it, takes on a tone that's quite sad, right? It's like kol od balev pima, as long as there is one beating heart, right? As long as there's some left, a nefesh yehudi homia, there's one nefesh that's still hopeful, right? Ulefatem mizrach kadima, and we search, right? There's like this like distant possibility that maybe it could be, which is appropriate for 1878. That was the first Aliyah. It was not a good time for Jews, right? So the context bore this out. I am the Tzion Sophia. We're all about hope. And what does Rav Kook say? Rav Kook is like totally different. Rav Kook says, La'ab chayai bovavenu. Okay? Forever it's alive in all of our hearts. It's not one heart, one person who's hopeful and maybe. Forever. Ha'emunah ha'ne'emanah. It's not a dream, it's a belief, and it's not possible, it's ne'eman, it's for sure. Lashuv el eretz kadshenu ir ba David Chana. And we see the same lashon, look at line 8, le'ir ba David Chana. He's saying, I hear you, but I see you in a different way. Right? I hear this concept that we need to return, but don't think it's some possible one last hope. It's actual, and it's a faith, and it is guaranteed that it will happen in some sort of like redemptive, messianic way. We just have to set the conditions right. Maybe they're here now, maybe they won't be, but it will be at some point, right? Another nice contrast would be line 10 in Imber versus line 6 in Rav Kook. Et kol echad cholenu, that's Herzl, av hamon kana, no. Sorry, it wasn't just Herzl. It was, who's Av Hamon Kana? That's Avram, right. It's not line 12. Gam achri tikvatenu. No, shema nichya chayenu. It's not just a hope, it's our life. Right? It's, and then if you go back down to Imber, if you look at the difference between line 20 versus Rav Kook's line 14, ki rachamenu Kel Zoam, the wrathful God will finally have pity on us. Like, we are these, like, lost souls who will literally not survive Golos. Verses 1 and 14, Mipi Elyon Nitna Netzachi Nachlatenu. Right? Mimidbar Matana. It's an entirely different tone. So Rav Kook is looking for a religious Zionist, and that, yes, he's willing to engage and he's willing to speak the language of secularists, and he thinks there's Kedusha there. It isn't just walk all over religious values. However, there are certain principles. There is a principle of Emunah, there's a principle of Geulah, there's a principle of moving in a direction of the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael, Torah Yisrael, and Am Yisrael, that Rav Kook certainly asserts, but doesn't claim that he can do it alone. We have that triangle, and anyone who's working along that triangle, according to Rav Kook, is to be valued and engaged and included in the growth and the development of religious Zionism. There's no question that that same tension exists continually. We don't even have to get into the developing new parties that are emerging now, and the ethics behind the various laws. A beautiful imagery that had been shared with me once before, and I don't know where it comes from, so if anyone does, I'd love to hear, is the notion that the triangle Rav Kook asserts as being totally interconnected becomes a part of our flag for a very purposeful reason, that Am Yisrael, Torah Yisrael, and Eretz Yisrael, sometimes we're up and sometimes we're down, but we have to always be connected.
Yes.
Thank you very much. I don't know the answer. Possible. Oh, I'm sorry, I do know the answer. Actually, the Ne'akiva movement and the Rav Kook communities do sing it. They all accept the Hatekva, but they actually do formulaically and formally sing it. I don't know it, but it is a part of their tekes, and it is definite. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Same too.